time to talk to Mark Austin, the multi-award winning journalist. He's witnessed some horrific stuff during his career. He's covered the war in Iraq, where his friend and colleague Terry Lloyd was killed by so-called friendly fire. He's witnessed South Africa's historic transition from apartheid to Nelson Mandela becoming president and all of the wonder of that. And then back to the horrific stuff, the horrors of the Rwandan genocide. He's written a book called And Thank You for Watching. I had a chance to speak to him over the weekend and I began by asking him if he had always wanted to be a journalist.
That's a good question. I think my earliest memory, I think, of a news event was when I was about 5 years old, and it was the Kennedy assassination. That's how old I am. And I think subconsciously, probably after that, I thought that was quite something to watch that on television. And then I watched, you know, people like Sandy Gall and Brian Barron and Martin Bell and John Simpson sort of travelling the world and covering these extraordinary events. And I think, you know, I thought that's not a bad way to spend your life. And I've been lucky enough to do it.
And how did you get in? What was your first job? So when you were at that age, whatever, 18, 19, 20, had you decided by then that's what you wanted to do?
Yeah, earlier than that, I think, actually. I was quite lucky. I knew that I wanted to do it, I think, probably about 16, 17. And in fact, I had to make a decision because I was about to go to university to do English, and I was sort of packing up a van with some mates to go down. And then I got offered a job on the local paper at the last minute. And so I agonized over this thing. And my father said, look, if you've decided what you want to do, get on and do it. And so I didn't go to university. I went straight onto the local paper and spent 2 years as a reporter on the local paper, and then managed to get a job at the BBC in London on a sort of short-term contract, and then, you know, managed to get a job as a national television reporter when I was about 23, 24. So I'm not sure that that would happen now, but it happened then, and I'm very grateful for it. And I was very lucky.
Do you think it was a mistake, looking back, not going to university?
No.
Because you usually only get one chance at that.
No, look, I'd like to have gone to university for various reasons, and I'd like to have done English at university, and I'd like to have read more, and I'd like the experience of university, and I miss that, I think. But I think that I just knew what I wanted to do, and I just got on and did it. And, you know, I could have come out of university with a sort of average English degree with loads of other people, and I might not have got the job that I managed to get. So no, I don't have any regrets like that. And also, you know, learning the trade on a local newspaper in those days was pretty important. And, you know, you learned a lot about councils and courts and you know, how to write a story. And I was very lucky on the Bournemouth Echo as well, because which was the paper I was on, because they had some very good sub-editors, one of whom was a young American out of Des Moines in Iowa, and he was starting out on his journalism career, and it was Bill Bryson. So,
Did you enjoy your time at the BBC?
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah, and I learned so much at the BBC, and I was very lucky, as I say, to become a reporter very early, and then I became a sports correspondent and travelled the world covering World Cups and test matches, and, you know, going to Wimbledon, and that was like a dream job in your late 20s, you know, just travelling the world watching sport. And then it led to becoming a foreign correspondent, which is what I wanted to do. So, you know, I keep saying I've been very lucky, but I have.
Is the life, Mark, of a correspondent, a foreign correspondent in particular, not a lonely life? That you often move away from everything you know, friends, family, and if you're good, you're sometimes moved around the world, so you don't get to set up a base of familiarity.
Well, my family moved around the world with me. So I was based in Asia for 6-7 years. I was based in South Africa at the time when Mandela became president, and my family were with me, young family there. And but having said all that, I spent 6 months away, even when I was based in Hong Kong or South Africa, because, you know, these were big continents, and I was traveling probably 6 or 7 months months of the year. So it is lonely in that respect. But of course, you do travel with a camera crew. And I've been very lucky to travel with some of the best cameramen in television news. And there is a great sense of camaraderie, and there's a great, you know, sense of team. And that kind of carries you through, and it carries you through in some of the more dangerous places. And the job's changed, Stephen, because, you know, there was a time in the sort of 80s and early 90s when journalists went and covered conflicts, and, you know, they were able to operate quite easily. Now, you know, journalists have become targets in many ways with the rise of the Islamist terrorism, and they're seen as journalists and foreign correspondents are seen as, you know, an arm of the state in some ways. And you know, I don't have to tell you those scenes of journalists being kidnapped and put in those jumpsuits. And so, you know, the role of a journalist and of a war correspondent, as a foreign correspondent, has become much more difficult, I think, and much more dangerous.
What was your most dangerous moment?
Well, I mean, my most dangerous moment, I think, the moment when I thought it might be all up was when in a place called Bophuthatswana, which was a territory of South Africa just before Mandela became president, and there were the extreme white right-wingers, Eugene Terreblanche, I don't know if you remember him, and his militia were trying to sort of support this homeland territory, and it got very violent, and we were filming them, and they got out of their pickup trucks, and they pointed their guns at myself and my producer, and they marched us into a field, and they objected to us filming them, and they just told us to stare straight ahead. They put the gun into the back of my head, just behind my ear.
It actually touched you, did it?
Yeah, and also my producer had the same thing, and that's when I did think perhaps that you know, but mercifully, one of their commanders came along and said they'd got, you know, better things to do than to kill us. So, but that was a time when I thought, and I did think then of all the places to die in a sort of patch of scrubland in a place called Bophuthatswana, I thought that would probably be a pretty anonymous death.
In 2003, and it was during the Iraq War, of course, your friend and fellow journalist Terry Lloyd was not so lucky. He was killed.
Yeah, and I write about this in the book, and in fact, I made a documentary about it with his daughter, but who wanted to go and see where it all happened. But it was a terrible day. It was the first day of the war, and Terry and I were good friends, and we'd gone to Kuwait together, and we were basically, you had to camp on the border in the desert, just on the border with Kuwait, and waiting for the troops to go in, for the British troops and the American forces to cross the border and go in. And Terry's plan was to get to Basra as soon as possible, because the British were aiming to get to Basra, and they thought it would fall quite quickly and there would be some sort of jubilation at the liberation of Basra. And Terry was very keen, very experienced foreign correspondent, very keen to get there. And I decided to go another way to a port city called Umkasar, which was where a lot of British troops would also be going. And my job was to try and present the news from as near to the front line as we could. Terry's job was, of course, to report. And so he set off overnight. And I can remember speaking to him the night before and, you know, wished him luck. And off he went with his camera crew. And he went too far. He didn't realise he was crossing a front line. The Americans were sort of in the sand. The tanks were buried in the sand and just visible, but he didn't see them. And he crossed that front line. He went too close to Basra. Some Iraqi militia were coming the other way. So he and his cameraman, they turned the two ITN vehicles round and headed back at quite high speed towards the Americans. And the Americans opened fire and basically incinerated the vehicles, and Terry was not killed instantly, but he was picked up by an Iraqi ambulance, which was then heading back to Basra, and the Americans opened fire on that ambulance as well. So, you know, it actually amounts to a war crime in my view, but these things are very difficult, and the Americans have never been held to account for it. But
why do you think that is?
Well, though, it's not through a lack of effort, Stephen. I mean, ITN tried, the coroner ruled that it was an unlawful killing, but the Americans' view was that they weren't going to hold their people to account because It was the fog of war, and it was unclear what the vehicles were, and they considered the vehicles posed a threat to their men. In fact, in the documentary,
do you accept that? No, I don't accept that.
Look, I don't accept that. No, but I'm in the documentary that I did with Terry's daughter. We actually tracked down the platoon commander in America, in Virginia, and he had left the forces by then. But he said, look, you know, my job was to protect my men, and these vehicles were coming from Basra at high speed, and we didn't realise they were press vehicles, and we opened fire. And he said I would do the same again. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that you know, people say that Terry was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, in fact, if you're a journalist covering a war, you know, he was in the right place at the right time. It was just terribly bad luck, and you know, we didn't, you know, the Americans did what they did, and I'm not sure British forces would have done that, but look, there we are.
Does it hurt?
It hurts a lot, Stephen, because he was, you know, he was a great reporter, he was a good friend, and then to see something like that happen to a colleague like that on the first day of a war, all sorts of things go through your head about what you're doing. And of course, we were told not to cross the border because this had happened, so we waited, and one of his cameramen is still missing. He's never been found, his body. The fixer's never been found. Terry's body was found. One of the cameramen did get back, and we had to go and pick him up at the border. And, you know, they say that people's hair stand on him when they're frightened. I've never witnessed it like I witnessed it that day. This cameraman came back, and his hair was standing on end, and he was truly terrified, and he managed to get out of the car and get back to the border. But look, it was just a terrible day for ITN and a terrible day for journalism.
All of the years that you've been in the business and given the totality of the stories that you've covered, my goodness, from Africa, Rwanda, the genocide, do you think that you must be emotionally scarred by what you've seen? You know, if someone else went out to at least even one of those scenes and experienced the death and destruction that a journalist witnesses, they would often have PTSD.
Well, I know some reporters who do suffer from that. And Rwanda, 1994 was an extraordinary year because I was in South Africa and I witnessed one of the most uplifting things I've ever witnessed, which was, you know, 28 million black South Africans vote for the first time in their lives to end apartheid and to vote for a black president and to, you know, make their lives, transform their lives and to transform South Africa. And it was a beautiful sunny day. And you know, they queued for hours and hours to cast this vote, you know, the first time. Just imagine what it was like for those people. And we filmed that and we spoke to them. And I can remember one grandmother saying, you know, I don't mind dying now because I know my children will be able to vote and we'll you know, it'll be a black man ruling this country at the end of apartheid. And, you know, they'd suffered so much. And it was a really uplifting story. But at the same time, what, a month later, the genocide in Rwanda had happened and we got sent there. So we went from this hugely uplifting story to probably the most depressing story I've ever covered, where, you know, a million people were killed in 100 days, slaughtered by machete wielding gangs, their neighbours.
Did you see some of that death?
No, we got there after most of it had happened, but there were bodies in the fields, there were children's, maimed children's bodies around, there were you know, the most appalling scenes. And then, of course, the Tutsi military came in and cleared out Rwanda of the Hutus, and, you know, several hundred thousand Hutus then fled, ended up on this whole expanse in Goma of volcanic rock with no food, no water. And we went to cover that, and people were dying literally in front of it. It's the only place I've seen. We go to a lot of places where people have already died, and you go to a lot of places where people may be about to die and you leave. But this was a situation in Goma where people were dying right in front of our camera, and it happened
from starvation or what?
Yeah, from starvation, from dehydration, from diarrhea, children dying from diarrhea, and people, there wasn't the help there. So, you know, it was a terrible time. And
Mark, when you're watching, when you're filming a situation like that as a journalist, do you capture what's happening, or do you reach into your stock of supplies and offer food?
Well, you see, it's very difficult because...
What do you do?
Well, your instinct is to go to the back of your car and to take out the case of water that you've got for yourself and your team and help people. And sometimes you do, but in situations like that, you would be mobbed. Yeah, we did. I can remember helping one child who got badly trodden in a stampede across the border, and we helped him and we managed to get him out, and we eventually reunited him with his family. So we do help, but you know, the problem is once you take food out or you take a box of water out in situations like that where there's just utter desperation around you, you will lose it, and you will lose. There'll be, you know, you could cause all sorts of problems. So it's very difficult.
I'm a relative wuss in that all of my kind of broadcasting career has been in a studio, a radio studio, a television studios now as well. When you then came back to the relative comfort of a television studio, did you get bored compared to being on the ground?
Yeah, look, it coincided with the time actually when Terry was killed and a lot of other journalists were being either wounded or killed. And I did decide that I thought, you know, there does come a time when your number's up. But I'd been, you know, my protection was my innate cowardice. And so I'd got by, but your time, you know, your luck will run out. And so I made a decision. I got offered a job of a newscaster back in London. And so I took it. And
for ITN?
For ITN, yeah. And it's not as satisfying. It's not as interesting. It's not the pure journalism that being a correspondent is. But, you know, I've got to be frank about it. You earn a lot more money. It's pretty safe. And you know, it's a nice warm studio. But
and before... Sorry.
It's not, I would say, look, I get asked a lot by youngsters saying, oh, I want to be a presenter. I want to be a presenter. How do I do it? And I said, well, look, go and be a reporter first. Yeah. Go and be a correspondent first. And
Because
that's the fun and it's the real journalism in my mind.
While preparing for this interview, I was doing some searches about you and up popped an article from on the Mail Online, end of October 2016, Feud at 10. ITV veteran Mark Austin quits the channel after a year of willy-waving clashes with rival Tom Bradbury.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you fall out with him?
No, not really at all. I mean, it was a very simple thing. I'd been doing News at 10 for 8 or 9 years, and they decided they wanted to do something else with the programme. And that's what happened. And
does that mean they decided they didn't want you?
Well, they wanted to do a different type of programme. So the sort of journalism I liked and the way I did News at 10 was to go on location as much as possible and to take the programme on location. But it is a very expensive thing to do. And they decided that they wanted a programme that's more political, more analysis, and Tom Bradbury was going to do it. So I went to the evening news. But in the end, I decided I wanted to go and do something else. And I wanted specifically to help my daughter, who was not very well at the time. And I write about that in the book. And she had pretty bad anorexia at the time.
So were you pushed out or not?
No. I left. I left after 30 years. But I wanted to do other things by that stage. So that's what I did. I mean, I made a documentary with my daughter, and she had been through terrible suffering, and the lack of resources and the lack of help that she got.
You were very open about that, weren't you? Because this is about your daughter's anorexia,
yeah,
Maddie, and you said that at one stage you said I couldn't deal with it all. I said things like, "If you want to starve yourself, starve yourself."
Well, look, I mean, we weren't public about it at all when it was happening. It was that when she got better, she actually came to me and said, look, we need to do something about this because the resources weren't there. It was treated as a Cinderella service. The whole issue of mental health and treatment of mental health in this country is and remains scandalous. You know, the idea of parity with physical health just not happening. So she wanted to do something, and I wrote a piece in the Sunday Times, and she wrote a small piece, and then, you know, it kind of steamrolled from there. And then we decided to do this documentary in which Prince William was happy to be interviewed and to talk about mental illness, and because anorexia is a mental illness. And, you know, and in answer to your question directly, I didn't understand it, and I did get it wrong, and I did say that to her, and I regret it deeply, and it broke my heart. And but we wanted to do something about it, and we did think that, look, if we don't do something, where, you know, I've got an opportunity to be able to make a film about it, and she was willing to do it, and she was better, then why not? And
so is she okay now?
Yeah, she's fine, Stephen. Thank you. And she's really good, and much, much better, and strong, and yeah, she's living a normal life. She's at Edinburgh University and doing really well.
I wish I had more time with you, but I do want to talk to you about America, because you've been covering Trump for the last year or so. My best mate, the closest mate I have, is a guy called Chris Buckler, who's the BBC's Washington correspondent.
Yeah, very good correspondent.
I talk to Chris all the time, every day, about how, you know, the next level of craziness from Trump.
Is it
difficult to cover the Trump story with impartiality when a lot of what's happening is crazy?
Well, it's difficult to cover it full stop because there is so much of it. I mean, I liken it to trying to drink from a fire hose, because every day there's another story and another piece of Trump madness. And it was the busiest I've ever been as a journalist. There's a story every day with Trump. You know, he tweets his pronouncement during his sort of morning ablutions, and that sets the tone.
Are you worried about his attack on journalists and the media, or do you think the media is strong enough to prevail?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, look, he is undermining the mainstream media with all this fake news stuff, because it quite clearly is not fake news. But he's undermining it. But at the same time, he is also prompting and provoking some of the best journalism I've seen, and certainly in the written press in the United States. But you've got to say that, you know, he's only doing what he promised to do, and his core support is still there. And, you know, they support his tax cuts, they support his hard line on immigration, they support his tariffs, and it's every chance that, you know, if the economy stays strong, he could serve two terms.
So, Mark, given how popular he is, what about the possibility that the tone and respect with which a lot of the mainstream media approach Trump is wrong? What about the possibility that Trump's got it at least half right,
and
the media half wrong?
Well, look, I think that is a very fair point. And I think my view going to report for a year the White House was that, look, this is a man who's won an election. Whether he didn't win the popular vote, no, but he won the system of voting that pertains in America. He won the Electoral College vote. So he was the president of the United States. So you've got to cover him like you would cover most other presidencies, although it is a totally abnormal presidency. I mean, he's a narcissist, he's a bully, he's a man who can't bear criticism.
You're supposed to, and I've done it too, so it's not a criticism, but because you're supposed to remain impartial, how do you get away with calling him a bully?
Well, because, you know, it's well documented that he has bullied people in the White House, and you know, it's he can't bear criticism. It's a fact. Those things are facts. But it's also a fact that he is doing everything he said he would do, and so you can't criticize him. You know, he said he would withdraw from the climate change deal. He withdrew from it. He said he would scrap the Iran deal when he was campaigning. He scrapped the Iran deal. He said he would impose tariffs and protect the steel industry. He's done it. So, you know, from that point of view, you've got to say fair play to him. And also, as I say, if the economy remains strong, there's every chance he'll get two terms. And you know, you have to report that as impartially as you can. But it's not, you know, you can still call it as you see it. It's it would be a dereliction of your journalistic duty if you didn't call it as you see it and say how abnormal this is and say how odd a way to run the presidency it is. Just ignore that.
I do just wonder what the whole landscape of media is going to be like in a few years' time. I don't know, 10 years' time down the line. given the internet and anybody can be a journalist now?
Well, look, I think one of the real dangers is the real fake news. And by that, I mean the fake news on social media and the mush and the noise and everything that's out there that is simply not fact. And I think that is a real problem for mainstream media, because you've got to decide, you know, what is and isn't fact. And I think, if anything, it makes what we do more important, Stephen, because people will want news they can absolutely trust. And I think I would go further and say fake news may even be good for journalism, because you may find young people now deciding, well, look, I pay for my music, I pay for my movies, I pay for everything else. Why don't I start paying for my online news if it's news we can trust? So I actually think that fake news, which is an awful phenomenon, I actually think it might help and make journalism better in the long run.
I've just one last question. The book is called And Thanks for Watching.
Yeah.
It's dedicated to your family, in particular your wife and Maddie. Yeah,
I know where you're going with this.
And to Didier Drogba.
Yeah, well,
what's that all about?
Well, my son and I went to we're big Chelsea fans, and we went to the Champions League final in 2012, and he basically won it for us against the run of play, I have to say. I mean, Chelsea didn't deserve to win it. So I thought I'd throw it in. Look, I have to say that my family weren't greatly enamoured by it, and my publisher did ask me if I wanted to take it out, but I kept it in. But well spotted. I think you're the first to spot that.